Order Thursday, January 18th at 1 p.m. Today we're going to be holding an informational meeting, and I'd first like to invite General Caldwell to speak.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department, and I was actually hoping that I would be third so I could see what the other guys are going to do, but I guess we'll just have to go with what we got. Thank you for this opportunity to speak to you today and about the men and women of the Oregon National Guard. The Oregon National Guard consists of approximately 8,400 citizen soldiers and airmen. We're located in every region of the state of Oregon and have 38 armories, 2 air bases, 4 major training areas, and we operate in a unique program 8 miles east of Bend in a former DOD site that's called the Oregon National Guard Youth Challenge Program. We have a dual mission that is promulgated in both the state and the national constitution. We're under the command of the governor until we are called by the president for federal duty, which has occurred at a consistent rate since the events of September 11, 2001. Since that day, the Oregon National Guard has mobilized for federal service over 5,000 of our members, the largest federal deployment in Oregon since World War II, which consists of over half the Air National Guard. And by the end of this federal fiscal year, we will have mobilized every one of our major units in the Army National Guard. We presently have 900 Army Guard soldiers in Afghanistan who are training the Afghan National Army. They're scheduled to return in June. The impacts that these mobilizations have created have caused us to reevaluate how we operate within the Oregon Military Department over the past 5 years and presented challenges that frankly we had not considered previously. As we began sending our soldiers off to war, I don't think any of us considered that the aftermath and the impacts of these mobilizations that they would have on the back end of the deployments. We discovered that our laws and structures simply were not adequate to take care of the special needs our people would encounter once the federal active duty was completed. We also recognized several inequities with respect to the federal laws and regulations that govern the National Guard and worked hard with the assistance and support of the Oregon legislature to rectify some of these laws and policies to better care for our troops after their federal service. Having said that, I can assure you that there's still a good deal of items that deserve attention and demand resolution as we continue to fight the global war on terror. As I stated, much of our accomplishments in the 2003 and 2005 legislative sessions better equipped us to properly administer the Oregon Guard before, during, and post federal deployments. I've attached a list of bills that this legislature passed in the most recent legislative session, and if you desire, I stand ready to discuss any or all of them based on your time and availability. I've also handed out a list of the proposed legislation for this session that will complement what we've already accomplished. You will note that our pre-session filing is relatively limited, primarily due to the substantial effort from the last session. I would note that most of what you see from the 2005 session was not proposed by the Oregon Military Department, but came from this body at the urging of Oregon citizens and interest groups in the veterans community. I would also admit that numerous pieces of legislation did not make it into law, most of which was for good reasons and the due diligence of the 2005 Veterans Committee. For that, in most cases, we are grateful. As I conclude my testimony, I would draw your attention to 2 significant accomplishments of the 2005 legislative session. The first is the establishment of the Emergency Relief Fund. This was, again, an idea that was generated by the committee and was funded in our budget for $500,000. Previous to this fund being established, the department operated a 501c3 relief fund that struggled to maintain $50,000, with most of the donations coming from the senior enlisted and officer ranks of the Oregon Guard. Most of the requests exceeded what the fund could manage, and over 90% of the awards were for loans that became problematic to repay. This new fund has adequate resources to make grants, not loans, and in my view has been extremely successful. Also, the legislature provided language to place this fund in the Oregon tax return donation list, which we hope will provide recapitalization as we have depleted the majority of the funds to date. I provided some information to you to get an idea of how we use this fund to assist soldiers and airmen over the past 18 months since its creation. The second significant success in the 2005 session was the funding of our reintegration team. Again, I provided a handout that you can review that gives you some idea of the very successful program. The team was a product of our realization that we were very good at preparing our soldiers for deployment, but upon return, we realized we were in a new, unfamiliar territory. The federal government simply had not accounted for the challenges we face as National Guardsmen when it comes to redeployments and the geography and the diversity of our organization. With the help of the legislature, we have established two state-funded positions and since reallocated two federal assets to form this team. The team has been very successful in the reintegration of our returning soldiers and airmen and has been recognized nationally for the excellent job we are doing in regard here in Oregon. In fact, the Oregon program has become the model for all the other states. We could not have been successful if it had not been for the partnerships we have formed with ODVA, the Employment Department, and numerous veterans organizations that have played and continue to play an essential role in this process. With that, I will include any my testimony and be available to answer any questions or work through the charts that I've given you as backup for this.
Thank you, General. Anybody have any questions? Do you want to run through the chart?
It's certainly up to you, Mr. Chairman. I would. I think there's a laundry list of bills that were presented. I think I would draw your attention probably to the reintegration package that I provided. And also, I didn't have to hand these out, but we came up with the refrigerator magnets. I'll give you each one of those. This was designed to not only for the soldiers upon return, but also for the family members. So we send the reintegration team out to work with families prior to the return of the soldiers at different family groups that we put together. And we put one of these, we give each one of them multiples of these refrigerator magnets. The significance of that is that we realized we had to come up with a 24/7 one-stop shop to assist soldiers upon their return from active duty. In many cases, we don't know what their struggles may or may not be, and the family members will notice things that probably nobody else will notice. And so we offered that number. We've had numerous calls on average, even today, with no units that are currently back in the last 6 months or a year. We're getting anywhere between 8 and 10 calls a week at all different hours of the day and night and on weekends, looking for help. And most of that is generated, quite frankly, comes from issues that don't manifest themselves, 3 to 5 or 10 days after they return home. And that is one of the problems that we're discussing, where we've been arguing and cajoling the Department of Defense to try to address, which is, we'll spend 3 to 4 months preparing somebody to go into combat, and they get 10 days to decompress and come home. One of the other interesting things that we've noticed in news articles that have been published here of recent was and I think I provided those to you, was that we're seeing a good number of the guardsmen, in particular in reservists to a lesser degree, that when they seek veteran service help, they're delayed to the point of taking like 137 days, I think is the average, 137 days to get people into PTSD help from the Veterans Affairs. Now, I'll tell you, here in Oregon, that has not been the case. The reason that hasn't been the case is part of this reintegration effort is we reached out to different groups and different organizations, and we've held summits every 6 months since about 6 months prior to our largest unit that had deployed, which is the 2nd Battalion, 162nd Infantry, when they were in Baghdad, Iraq. And we put this group together because, frankly, we were in ground that we had not plowed before and we needed to have some assistance. So these summits have paid us great dividends because what we've gotten is great, great interconnections with not only the employment department, but also the veterans organizations, and our people have gotten priority. So we don't fit that particular article that I passed out in your packet here in Oregon. Now, that having said that, our problem is mainly geography. We have folks that are scattered all over the 36 counties of this state, and the only place they can get service is Portland, Medford, or Walla Walla, or Boise. So needless to say, you don't have to really know Oregon geography all that well to know that if you got somebody in Bend, they got a long way to go to get help, regardless of where that service is. VA has stepped up and put a program into Bend now, at our urging, based on these summits that we've been having and getting this feedback. So I would tell you that I think from our perspective, we're probably in as good a shape as any state in the union with respect to our relationships and the service we're able to give our people. That still is not going to cover 100% of the folks. We still have people that have difficulties that we find out about. These refrigerator magnets hopefully will let us know about it before we find out about it in the police blotter. which is, you well know, is in the middle of the night. That's where that happens. So we're very, very pleased about our results. We're very pleased about the assistance we've gotten from our partners, and particularly the ODVA and veterans groups, and also the employment department, because we've got a major jobs program we're running. I give you a handout on that as well. And that jobs program has been wildly successful. And I think that as we move on through this next group, we're going to see even more positive things come out of that.
Okay. Representative Shelford, do you have a question?
Thank you. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, General, I support your efforts here. My brother is a veteran, and he uses the VA hospital extensively for a lot of reasons. But that's not my question. On your agenda here, the water for fire training, which I support completely. I was on the water committee in 03, and anytime you say the word water in this building, all kinds of antenna come up. And you don't, if you don't have the answer to this now, I just want to ask you, is there any opposition? Has anybody called you with concerns? Do you see any problem passing this through this session?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Schaffler, we haven't seen any opposition at this point.
Good.
The reason that we show it as being canceled in our legislative proposal,
it actually
came under another agency. The Water Regulatory Agency picked it up and recognized it as something that needed to be done, so we backed ours out and fell in on top of theirs. They've not indicated to us in any way that this is going to be problematic. One of the nuances about putting water on forest fires is that there's certain regulatory guidance from the Federal Forest Service and the BLM. The pilots have to be trained in order to do that. Sometimes, unfortunately, we have based on rotations of pilots and air crews and deployments, et cetera, we've ended up, in some cases, we've only had two trained pilots in command in order to do this kind of work. So what you do is you stick the second guy in the left seat and say you fly with him for X amount of hours to get your ticket checked, and then you can fly your own helicopter. Well, that's simply not the way to go about responding to these things. So we said we need to get this certification or this availability to these water sources so these guys can get trained before the fire starts. And right now we're not in the best of condition with respect to our certified pilots. So if we can get this done this session, we're hoping that we can get the training done in June and July time frame, so when the fires start in August and September, that we have a crane crews ready to go.
We got my support, so thank you.
And I don't have the bill number. I apologize.
That's okay.
But I'll make that link up and let you know that this is the bill that we're going to be working on, and this is the one we want to see get through.
Does anybody else have any questions about this? You don't need to go down if we don't have any questions. Okay, thank you, General.
Well, I appreciate it. Again, I want to stress that this committee, in my mind, was extremely successful in the last session. I think Representative Boquist, I think, is the only standing, veteran on this Veterans Committee. And most of the ideas came from the committee and or citizen groups. Great ideas. And that laundry list, that two pages that I gave you, accomplished a good deal of things that desperately needed changing. And the people sitting behind me who have those good ideas were able to bring those forth, and this committee moved them out. And I think we're in better stead than a lot of states are right now with respect to how our Oregon statutes relate to us. So I appreciate your support, and we'll be available for any questions.
Okay, thank you, General. Next, I invite Joseph Riley and Nicole Palmateer.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Nicole Palmateer. I represent the Oregon County Veterans Service Officers Association, and Frank Fryer, who was going to attend with me, was unable to make it, so we have Joseph Riley, who is the vice chair of our association, here to talk to you about the role of the County Veterans Service Officers.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Joseph Riley. I am the Lane County Veterans Service Officer and the vice president of the Oregon County Veterans Service Officers Association. As some of you may know, each county except Marion Polk, who's covered by the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, each county has within it a County Veterans Service Officer. Some of the smaller counties share a service officer who basically rides circuit among those counties. Our mission is to meet with the veterans, meet with their families, meet with their dependents face-to-face, explain to them the VA benefit process, what may be available to them, and then to assist them in the application process, advocate for them in that process, and attempt to ensure that the VA grants to them the maximum benefit to which they're entitled under the law. We do this by interviewing the veterans, by helping them obtain their military records, helping them obtain statements in support of their claims, many things which the veteran indicates happened during his or her service needs to be verified through objective evidence. We help get that evidence through statements or military records. I feel fortunate in the sense in that I don't have a tangible benefit to provide to my clients. Instead, I can solely focus not on whether, you know, the resources are such that this person should be granted benefit or whether they, if all the evidence is in the file. It's my role simply to advocate for that benefit, to advocate for that veteran, to help them satisfy the VA in proving that they are eligible for these benefits. The folks that we serve are veterans from all eras and their family members. For the most part, in Lane County, probably the percentages are maybe 40% Vietnam-era veterans, 30% World War II Korean-era veterans, as well as their surviving spouses, and 20% Iraq and Afghanistan veterans and recently discharged veterans. The rest may be peacetime errors and other periods. And as General Caldwell mentioned, there's nearly 1,000 Oregon Guards individuals in Afghanistan right now, and so we're expecting a large wave to hit the counties when they come home in the spring. And so many of the CVSOs do outreach to the local armories, explain, meet with them, let the folks there know who we are. And so we make efforts to make sure that these folks know that we're available to them. The main issues that face our clients are general benefits questions. Department of Defense does a much better job now informing separating veterans as to what their benefits may be. Historically, that was not something that was a focus for Department of Defense. So we have a lot of veterans from maybe this program, the transition program started in the 80s. Prior to that, they really had no debriefing on what was available to them through the VA. So there's probably not a day goes by where I mention a benefit that someone might be eligible for that they don't say, really, I never heard of that. I had no idea that that was out there. For the most part, the benefit that is unknown to the veterans is a non-service-connected pension. It's a safety net benefit available to any veteran who served during a period of war. The VA looks at the veteran's income, assets, and medical expenses. And if the income after paying medical expenses is below a certain level, the VA can help out with those expenses. If the veteran's under 65, they have to show disabilities which prevent them from working. Once the veteran hits 65, there's no disability test. It's strictly this income test. So we help a lot of World War II and Korean veterans if they go into a long-term care setting, meet those long-term care expenses. There's also a survivor spouse pension, which helps surviving spouses meet those long-term care needs. Benefit questions, accessing health care is probably the second most urgent issue for our veterans. In order to meet that, we will help them apply for access to Veterans Health Administration care through either the Portland VA Medical Center or the Roseburg VA Medical Center. They have to meet certain eligibility criteria. It's either an income test, they were a POW, received a Purple Heart, or if we can have the VA benefit folks acknowledge that this person has a service-connected disability, that's often a way that we can get them in the door for VA health care. The third most prevalent issue among our clients is probably emergency assistance. So I commend this committee and the legislative body from last session in addressing that and creating not only within the Guard and Oregon Military Department an emergency assistance program, but also one administered by Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. Last quarter, we had at least 20 veterans access that program, anything from immediate assistance with rent, emergent dental or other health care needs, pretty much getting that veteran over an acute financial crisis to a point where they'll be able to be back on their feet. I would also like to commend this committee and the legislative body on passing Senate Bill 1100 last year. As you know, that expanded and enhanced County Veterans Service Office services. Most counties have been able to add staff or at least expand the hours of their current veteran service officer if that person's not full-time. Just in Lane County, last quarter, compared to the second quarter of fiscal year 05-06, we increased our person-to-person interviews by almost 400. And of that, almost 100 was in outreach appointments. So these appointments are in the community. We travel out to Florence, to Blue River, Junction City, Cottage Grove, Oak Ridge, we go out to Florence once a week. There's a huge community out there of veterans, and so to prevent those folks from having to come in the town to see us, I have a service officer going out there once a week. Also, those increase in outreach visits includes going to veterans who are housebound, going to veterans who are in a care facility, those veterans who are the least able to come see us, we make the effort to go out and see them. I hope that's a good summary of what the County Veterans Service Officer does. I feel like we're an integral part of the VA benefit system. We don't provide a benefit, but we're really there to guide that veteran through the process, help them. Well, as you may know, it's a lot easier to fill out governmental forms if that's what you do all day. Seeing these forms for the first time really strikes fear in a lot of our veterans' heart. And we're there to help them through that and help to make sure that the VA gives them everything that they've earned through their military service or through the veterans' military service if they're dependent. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Any questions or comments from the committee? Okay, thank you very much.
All right, yeah. Thank you.
And next, Mr. McDonald and Mr. Willis.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Matt McDonald. I represent the United Veterans of Oregon. United Veterans of Oregon is every federally chartered veterans organization in the state, plus others that are not federally chartered. In order for me to come up and support a bill, every member of that organization must agree with the bill. If one member disagrees, I cannot support it under the United Veterans of Oregon. To go back a little bit into history, when I was a 13-year-old boy in 1942, at a Memorial Day service, I was asked to recite from memory Flanders Fields. And in standing there in the cemetery, looking at the veterans coming in, Spanish-American War veterans, looked ancient to me, and of course, then my father brought in the World War I veterans with their old three rifles for a salute. And then in the crowd, there were World War II veterans home on leave. And when I got home, my father took us, my brother and I, aside. And he said, I want to tell you something. When those old people that you saw out there, the Spanish-American War veterans, came home, the government did nothing for them. When we came home from France in World War I, we were promised bonuses. And several of us went to Washington, D.C. and set up a shanty village called Hooverville, which the Army promptly destroyed, and we never got our bonuses. This time it will be different. And my brother said, how can you be sure of that? He said, you remember about a month ago, the two gentlemen were here with their wives and we had dinner. The one tall, lanky one and the short one that had glasses that we played the piano and sang some World War I songs. And he said, yes. He says, they'll make sure that veterans are taken care of. The tall, lanky one happened to be Leverett Saltonstall, who was a Republican from the state of Massachusetts. The short man wearing glasses happened to be Harry Truman. Why were they at our home? Because Harry Truman and my father served together and were lifelong friends. He said, they will make a difference. And World War II did make a difference. We got a veterans insurance. We got a GI Bill. We got training. We got grants to start businesses. And this country soared from an agricultural into really an industrial nation. 5 years later, the war came in Korea. And I remembered the parades and all the hullabaloo on the front page of the papers. But when I came home from Korea, there were no parades. You might find something about Korea on the fourth or fifth page. And our GI Bill was watered down. 10 years later, we're in a place called Vietnam. And in Vietnam, we stayed there from basically 63 to 75. And I came back from Vietnam, my last tour out of three, and flew back in Global Airways, which was a contract aircraft. And while waiting in the airport in California to come back to Dallas Airport to meet my family, I was in civilian clothes, but I had what they call a val pack, which was like a suitcase. And a young man came up to me and said, are you a veteran? Not a veteran. Are you in the military? And I said, yes, and he promptly spit in my face. And I was lucky because the policeman caught him before I did, because I would have probably broke his neck. Flew back to Dallas, was 2 or 3 hours late, coming into Dallas. My wife and two children were there. They met me on the way home. They hadn't eaten. We stopped to eat. And we were talking about the year that I was gone. And my children had every childhood disease I think that you can get. But she said the worst thing that happened to her when I was gone was 2 nights after I left, she got threatening telephone calls because I was a Marine and I was in Vietnam. About a week later, she got pounding on the front door. She called the police. And the police came, and the first thing the policeman said, ma'am, please put down that weapon. She had a pistol. And it kind of broke the ice. My son said, my mama's going to get him. But the policeman was smart, and he said, here's what I want you to do, Mrs. McDonald. I want you to find the person that has the loosest tongue in the area and tell them that you have a weapon and that if someone comes, you will use it. And out of Vietnam, we got some benefits, but it took the courts to finally say Agent Orange causes cancer, birth defects, and other things. And now we're at a point now where we're at war in Afghanistan and Iraq. And today, we're looking at these people coming back, some in coffins, some messed up for the rest of their lives. And I think it's our responsibility to take care of them. Some veterans come back fine, but I can tell you that anyone that's been in combat is not the same as before they were there. I'd like to read a quote from Memorial Day 2006. These are the words of George Washington, and they are true today as they were true the day he wrote them. Veterans, all veterans deserve every laurel, every honor, every tribute, and every word of praise that this nation can bestow. But ceremonies and solemn words, no matter how true and how heartfelt, are not enough. We shouldn't be repaying real services to our country with lip service. That means that we must make sure that our brave troops in Afghanistan and Iraq complete their service, that they, when they complete their service, they must receive medical care, education, job training that they need, and the economic opportunity that they have earned. Governor Kulongoski, May 30th, 2006. We look forward to a good session. You all have a paper in front of you. The veterans have prioritized the bills that they want passed. If you have any questions, you can contact me anytime. I live here in Salem, and I'm here most of the time. But we thank you for your support and hope that you follow the governor. Thank you.
Thank you. The list you gave us, Mr. McDonald, are those already bills, or is that just...
I've asked several people to drop those bills and get them down to legislative council.
Okay.
Some are being dropped in the Senate, and some are being dropped in the House. But we're trying to get all of them dropped, at least by this week.
Okay, and if you have some that aren't, please get a hold of me, and we'll...
We'll
see
do.
We can't get those on the road for you.
If there's any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Any questions from the committee? Thank you very much for your
Thank
testimony.
You.
And Mr. Willis.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Willis. I'm director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. I'd like to thank you and the committee for the opportunity to come here today to give you an overview of our department as we begin this legislative session. The Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs was created by the Oregon Legislature in 1945. Initially, this department was formed primarily to offer low-interest home loans to returning service members from World War II and to assist them in obtaining their benefits through the Federal Department of Veterans Affairs. The department is the state government's advocate for Oregon's 362,000 veterans. We also represent, along with the National Service Officers and the County Veteran Service Officers, their dependents, surviving spouses, and other family members. The department provides below-market interest rate loans to qualified, eligible veterans for home acquisition and home improvement. The department provides eligible veterans, spouses, surviving spouses, and parents whose children died while serving in the armed forces, skilled nursing care at the Oregon Veterans Home located in the Dalles. So I need to review that because we do get questions sometime about that. Clearly, it's a veterans home, so qualified veterans stay there. Their spouses may also join them there. Surviving spouses can qualify to stay there. But the one people don't know very much about is the fact that parents whose children were killed in wartime are also eligible to apply for residency at the Oregon Veterans Home. That's just another benefit by public policy that this state has passed that is not uniform across the country, but it is allowed under codified federal regulations, or CFRs, under which we have to operate our veterans home. The department assists thousands of veterans, their dependents and survivors, with claims for entitlement to federal, state, and local government benefits. The department also assists qualified veterans by providing educational and vocational training opportunities. We also provide a conservatorship service to approximately 194 Oregonians who have been legally determined by the courts to be protected persons and who are unable to manage their federal affairs. This program generates approximately $385,000 in federal VA funds per month. And so by an administrative fee from that total allocation of funds, we are able to operate our conservatorship services. These services in the past might well have been known as a guardianship. In any event, that unit operates very successfully from our headquarters office here in Salem, and we are able to take additional people as they are court-ordered into our program. We also operate, as I mentioned, the Veterans Home Loan Program. Actually, the loan program was authorized by the voters of Oregon, and it is in the Constitution, by a vote in 1944. And, of course, that made it necessary, let me put it that way, for the state to create the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. What this body should be proud of, however, was that the 1944 Veterans Home Loan Program was not the first time that that benefit was made available to Oregon wartime veterans. In fact, the Oregon legislature passed a similar allocation in 1921 for World War I veterans. It went for several years, basically until the allocation of funds ran out. But when it was time to look at taking care of the World War II returnees, it was the 1921 language that the body looked at and from that created and crafted the program that's been in place all these years. The program that we have in Oregon not only assists Oregon's veteran population, but also helps stimulate a variety of industries by increasing the pool of borrowers who can afford to purchase a home. Since 1945, our department has made in excess of 333,000 home loans and has returned to the Oregon economy $7.5 billion associated with that program. Due to the current restrictions in federal law, this program depends on lendable funds from two different sources. Proceeds from the sale of qualified veterans mortgage bonds, and I should mention those are tax-free, can be used to fund home loans for veterans up to 25 years from date of discharge. That 25 years from date of discharge language is contained in the IRS tax code that governs the use of the qualified veterans mortgage bonds. The department's pre-Allman bond program refunds bonds that produce a limited amount of lendable dollars that can be used to fund home loans for veterans up to 30 years from date of discharge. And that language is in the Oregon State Constitution. So it could be a little confusing to some people, but the bottom line is we have a fund source that would allow us to make a home loan to a veteran up to 30 years from date of discharge. And certainly all who would qualify under the other one could get a home loan up to 25 years from date of discharge. And much as Joseph Riley mentioned to you from the County Veteran Service folks and also General Caldwell, the key to any of these benefits, and especially the home loan benefit, is to let the veteran and their family know about that benefit early on so that they don't wait, and I've seen it happen, 25 or 30 years, and they come into the office and they're 60 days over the time that they could apply. And it breaks your heart, because this is a benefit that's been sitting there for them for three decades. So our job, and I think the staff does a great job of this and our other veteran service partners, is to make sure that these veterans understand the totality of their benefits and then allow them a place to come and sit down with a counselor to talk about those things. One of the ways that we make sure that this happens in Oregon is that we have set up a network of 172 approved lenders throughout Oregon. So you do not have to come to Salem or Portland or Bend or any place like that to initiate your Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs home loan. If you go to a qualified lender, approved lender in Lakeview, you do all of your work with that one lender and you never leave town. Same thing in Baker City and across the state. So I'm really proud of how that program works. We are members of the Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association, or Mortgage Bankers Association, and We currently service a loan portfolio of in excess of 6,000 home loans. And so far in the 2005-2007 biennium, we've made, in about 18 months, 298 loans that equal $65.7 million. For the 2007-2009 biennium, it's expected that we'll make about 472 home loans, and their value will be $102,896,000. This program is good for Oregon, it's good for its economy, and it stimulates all of the home loan industries and building industries. It's a great investment. And I'm certainly glad that our predecessors back toward the end of World War II decided to offer this home loan benefit to our returning veterans. Oregon is only one of five states that has a state home loan program. They are Alaska, California, Texas, Wisconsin, and Oregon. Mississippi had a home loan program for a short period of time, but they funded it with state money, and when they had some recession problems, they just no longer had the money to run the program, and so it went from six states down to five. We are responsible for the repayment of approximately 20% of the state's general obligation fund debt. That amounts to about $768 million. We have obviously been surveyed or audited many times in our home loan program. It's an annual event. We look forward to getting the clean bill of health every year. We are solid. We are in the black. And we expect to stay that way as far as the Veterans Home Loan Program. The Veterans Service Program has been described in large part by the testimony of Joseph Riley, the County Veterans Service Officer from Lane County, because the Veterans Service Program that the state offers the same kinds of things that are offered through our County Veterans Service folks. The department does provide all veteran services for the veterans in Marion County and Polk County, which are the two counties not serviced by the County Veterans Service officers. The U.S. Department of Affairs estimates the current population in Oregon, again, as 362,104 veterans. That's down about 4,000 from the previous veteran population numbers. And sadly, that is primarily due to the loss of our World War II generation. Many of the survivors and dependents who receive federal aid and assistance and state and county aid and assistance are not included in that 362,000 number. That number is only veterans. So we also do a lot of work with dependents and survivors. Currently, Oregon ranks sixth in the nation in average monthly compensation paid to our veterans, and we are third in the nation in average pension payments. During the 2005-2007 biennium, Oregon veterans can expect to receive over $1 billion in compensation and pension benefits. Now, what that means to me in raw numbers is this. If we spend for all state-funded veteran services in the neighborhood of $5 million, that's everything that we pass through to county government, that's everything we pass through to the national service organizations, and that's what we pay for our state service officers, around $5 million. If our return on investment for that $5 million in compensation and pension alone is $1 billion, I would submit to this committee and to this body that that is one of the best returns on investment for a state general fund dollar that there is anywhere in state government. I would also stress that that does not include the money that is saved from our health and social services money through DHS by enrolling these qualified veterans in the federal health care program. And the size of that program is amazing. In the nation today, there are nearly 26 million veterans across the country. Of that 26 million, about 7,500,000 are actively enrolled in the VA healthcare system. So it is a system with wait lines. It is a system that both the federal VA and all of us who are veterans advocates are working to reduce the amount of time that it takes a veteran to see a primary care physician, to schedule an operation, to have some kind of a dental procedure done. Right now, those wait lines are too long. And one of the things that I've always asked some of the lawmakers in Washington, D.C., where they can do the most good about fixing this, is if you're a member of Congress and you become ill, how long before you get to see a doctor? And, of course, that's a rather academic question. But I know how long it is before a veteran gets to see one, and we need to fix it. And so we're all working on it together. And, in fact, I'm going to be testifying before Congress next month on that issue, along with the National Association of State Directors of Veterans Affairs. So I must go on and say that we do maintain a relationship with 34 county governments and with the National Veteran Service Organizations, most of whom are represented by Mr. McDonald, who's sitting here with me. We do this through a statewide service delivery partnership, and our state veteran services program monitors, as I said before, thousands of claims awarded to Oregon veterans and also provides our monthly educational and training assistance to qualified veterans. It is not enough to simply take the claim in. The claim then needs to be monitored over the years so that you can assure that that veteran continues to receive the benefits that they're entitled to, or if there's a deterioration in their service-connected illnesses, that the percentage of compensation may well be increased so that they may be better cared for. So that's why they're continued to be monitored. The general fund dollars that we use, that I mentioned to you before, make up the majority of funds which the department uses to support our claims and counseling offices in Salem and in Portland, our educational assistance, technical training, and the statewide network of state, county, and national veteran service officers. Other fund revenues are generated from fees charged to most of our conservatorship client accounts, and I gave you the number on the income on conservatorship. Finally, let me visit just briefly with you about the Oregon Veterans Home at the Dalles. The purpose of the Oregon Veterans Home is to provide veterans with access to high-quality nursing home care at an affordable price. The home, located in the Dalles, provides skilled nursing care and cares for veterans suffering from Alzheimer's disease and other dementia. The home also offers outpatient rehabilitation care to some of Oregon's most vulnerable veterans. Veterans, spouses, and surviving spouses, and those parents whose children died in service to the armed forces, are eligible to be admitted to our home. It is a single-story, 75,000 square foot, 151 bed facility located on 5 acres of donated land. It offers a home-like environment complementing the philosophy of personal independence. I might add that that's demonstrated by a philosophy that all of us have about the home, and that is when someone is employed up there to take care of these wonderful people. I call the Oregon Veterans Home the place where honor lives, because that's how I feel about it. Others say we care for heroes every day, and that's also true. But one of the key things that we tell volunteers and employees who are at our home on a regular basis, and including visitors who come to the home, is remember, you work where they live. They don't live where you work. This is their home. So you either work here, or you volunteer here, or you make deliveries here, or what have you. But remember to respect the fact that this is their home. And so that's our philosophy about it. And I know the residents appreciate being treated like that. In any event, the operation of the home day-to-day is provided by the Veterans Care Centers of Oregon. That is a private, not-for-profit organization that operates under a contract with the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. The cost of care is borne primarily by the residents. The department receives a per diem grant payment from the federal VA for providing care to the veterans. The federal VA also provides prescription medications and durable medical equipment to most of the home's residents. The home operates entirely on other fund dollars and has served over 800 residents since it opened 10 years ago in 1997. Strategically and for the immediate future, I want to echo something that General Caldwell told you about, and that is our effort together using a number of agencies to meet the demand in two critical areas coming out of Afghanistan and Iraq. We are seeing a higher level of post-traumatic stress disorder than we have seen in prior wars. And this is not on a per capita basis. I mean, this level is the highest that we've seen. That's one issue. The other is traumatic brain injury. And it doesn't take a lot of thought to remember that if the only thing sticking out of the top of an armored vehicle is someone's head, there's a very good chance that we're going to see some traumatic injuries, especially when we're seeing the rocket-propelled grenades and the IEDs. So we have to focus on the fact that we are going to take care of these people for decades. And we need to have the treatment methodologies in place and the network of treatment now, right now, so that we don't find out about that PTSD victim from, as General Caldwell said, a police blotter or an arrest report. As a result of others believing that, it's interesting that today, in fact at 4 o'clock today, there is a task force meeting that is led by Attorney General Hardy Myers that will include the Director of the Board on Public Safety Standards and Training, John Menis. It will include General Caldwell. It will include myself and other interested parties who are going to try to accomplish several things. One of them, of course, is to raise an awareness across the board about the symptoms of PTSD, and then about who are the people who can provide care, and I mean immediate care, for those people that need the help. And then, of course, how to identify it in a high stress, how to identify the symptoms in a high stress situation. If we are able, and I'm positive we will be able to, put in the curriculum at the Oregon Police Academy for state, county, and municipal police officers a block of instruction for entry-level officers that talks about what to be looking for and then what are your resources available when you find this situation, that's going to be very helpful. Then to train it into the field with existing officers as in-service training is going to be also very, very helpful. Then to make sure that the service providers know that that element of Oregon public safety professionals is trained up so that they're ready for what I think will be an increase in referrals. And nothing about what I'm saying to you changes anything about the officer's responsibility to take whatever legal action based on the actions of the person. What we're saying is we can do both. If that person has committed a crime, obviously they're going to have to stand for that. But they also can have a referral so that we don't deal with that PTSD issue for years and years and years without ever providing any kind of help for that person. With regard to traumatic brain injuries, we have far too few facilities in our country to deal with this influx of badly wounded people. I would like to see, and I know the director in Washington State who I've talked to would like to see, a much more expanded ability to treat and to recover to whatever extent possible these folks who have been so badly injured so that they can, to the level of their ability, be as productive in their communities as is humanly possible. There will be a number of issues coming before this committee and others that I'm not touching on today that are part of McDonald's list here that I'll be happy, that I'm sure we will visit about in later hearings. I feel like I've tried to give you a really good overview of where we are as a department. I also want to thank this committee for the good work that it did in the past and the excellent work that I think we're going to get done in this session. I want to thank you for providing the emergency assistance program. We, like the National Guard, were allocated $500,000. We will not make it to June 30 of 07. We are going to run out of money. We knew there was a need out there, But I will just, I'd like to end on a high note with you by simply telling you this. That $500,000 over the last 18 months has meant the difference between some of our veterans becoming homeless, and they did not because of this one-time grant. It meant the difference with indigent veterans having for the very first time a set of dentures, and they can now eat as a normal person. Changed the entire quality of their life. It has meant the difference between becoming homeless and having enough bridge dollars to set yourself in place and continue to live independently. And finally, it's made the difference between being employed or unemployed. Where you had someone going from one job to the other, they did not have the sustainability to make it between the stop time of the other job and the start time of the next one. And we were able to bridge them across, and as a result, they did not become unemployed, and they stayed self-sufficient. That was the work of this committee, and that's about real people that live across our state that have been helped because of the work that you did last session, and I hope that you will continue this next session. Mr. Chair, that concludes my overview, and thank you very much, and I'll answer any questions.
Thank you. That was a very good overview, real complete. Any questions from the committee at all? Thank you, gentlemen. I really appreciate your taking the time to come in. Does anybody else wish to testify today?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to bring up one thing, that Oregon isn't alone in these bills. The state of Illinois and the state of Massachusetts have provided grants to veterans. Giving to those killed in action grants to the families. They have launched a program through the lottery to give $5 million per year to veterans. They have given educational benefits, provide four-year education for veterans and families that have been killed in action or 100% disabled. They've offered educational assistance when needed and grants when filing for civil service. So other states are doing what we're asking you to do. Thank you for your patience.
Thank you. Yeah. Okay, anything further for the committee today? With nothing further, we'll conclude today's meeting, and I thank the people who spoke today. It really helped us out with the information you gave us.
Much more.
Meeting adjourned.